You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter in a wonderful Davis day. You know, it's the last day of December of 2025 when we're recording this.
Correct.
And that year went so fast on it, and it was so strange weather-wise. But it looks like we're going to have rain for the next week, so that's good.
Yeah, strange weather-wise is a good way to put the entire month of December, what we just went through. It is presently 43 degrees, at least at the University Airport in Davis, on the morning of New Year's Eve. This will broadcast on New Year's Day 2026. Happy New Year, everybody. We're going up to a high today of apparently 48 degrees, and I'll be surprised if we even get there. Yesterday, I don't know if we ever got that high. It's been foggy for the last couple of days. We've got rain coming in, and really depends on which weather site you look at as to how much we're going to get. Once again, these storms are mainly going around us in terms of totals. That's been the pattern here in Davis throughout this rainfall season so far. But we've got a chance of rain tonight. Well, they're not even saying chance. Rain and patchy fog tonight. 48 degrees will be the low. New Year's Day, 57 degrees and rain. Well, 57 degrees would be, I guess, an improvement in terms of what we've dealt with the last couple of days. Thursday night, rain, chance of rain only going down to 52. Friday, 56 degrees and rain. Friday night, 53 degrees and rain. How about that? A 3-degree temperature swing in a 24-hour period. Saturday, 55 degrees and showers. Saturday night, partially going to be some showers with 49 degrees. Sunday, rain likely. Mostly cloudy, 53. Sunday night, rain likely, 47. Monday, rain likely, 52. You can get the pattern here. Monday night, chance of rain. Mostly cloudy, low about 46. Tuesday, chance of rain, partly sunny with a high near 52. And I can tell you that our fruit trees will be arriving on Tuesday. So partly sunny would be an improvement, I think, over cold rain and fog.
You said that the high was 48 today. And the low was 48. That's no difference between day and night,
yes.
Don.
We'll see how that plays out. That will be in the past by the time the show broadcasts. We'll update you next week. We got a lot of rain in California on Christmas Day and the day before and after. The one part of the state that was not under just a whole pile of weather alerts and watches and things was where we are.
Davis.
Tons of rain in Southern California. I mean, major rainfall down there, up in the Pacific Northwest. 4 feet plus of snow at almost all sites in the Sierras. Some places got 5 feet plus. Ski resort operators are jumping for joy at this point because they were walking around on bare dirt as recently as 10 days ago. We received a lot of moisture all over the state, except these storms went just north of Sacramento, Davis area, or just south of the Central Valley. And this looks like the pattern once again. They are talking about several days of rain. And when I add it all up, the one site that I do like to look at for that is Weather Underground, although I will say that they always run high in terms of their rainfall projected totals. But they're looking at Davis having looks like about 3 to 4 inches over the next several days, possibly. And then I jump over to, say, Vacaville or some site closer to the Bay Area, and they're looking at 5 to 6. So this is the pattern. Storms come in, they hit the Bay Area, they hit the wine country. The Coast Range, of course, causes significant orographic effect as the clouds move up rapidly and squeezes out the moisture, as we've explained before. And then as it comes on into the valley, you get less rainfall. So in one major storm just a few days ago, Davis got less than an inch. Vacaville, which is to the west, got 1.5 to 2 inches, depending on which weather station you were looking at. And that's a very common pattern. Lake Berryessa is rising pretty rapidly, and it's almost a certainty if we get anything close to normal rainfall pattern over the rest of this season that it will overflow the wonderful drain plug that causes people to drive up there and take pictures. That
The
will be
glory hole.
the morning glory hole, the glory hole, whatever you want to call it. Is a fascinating tourist attraction when it's overflowing. It looks like a giant bathtub. Well, it's a real high likelihood we'll get there. Temperatures, let's talk about chilling hours real briefly. We have now received, depending on whether you're using the Utah model or the old model, the Utah model, 709 chilling hours, and it's not even January. And in the older model, which was a little more conservative, 475 chilling hours, which is good, middle of the range. High end, if you're using the Utah model, which is interesting because we'd had hardly any by the middle of November. So in just a matter of 4 to 6 weeks, we got pretty much what most of our fruit trees need in this area. Got our fog out of the way, got our chilling out of the way, getting our rainfall out of the way. Let's move on to spring. The difference
So,
between these two models, by the way, I've never seen such a stark difference. Normally, the normal model, the one I've been tracking since 1980, is the hour is 32 to 45 degrees. Okay. The Utah model, they found that actually the low end should be 34 degrees, but chilling still occurs at a full strength, you might say, up to 50 degrees. So the Utah model, 34 to 50 degrees, 709 chilling hours. The older model, 32 to 45 degrees. Doesn't seem like that much of a difference, 475 hours. A big part of that. We spent about 10 days where it was above 45, but below 50. So we know now that trees are still getting what they need, 45 to 50 degrees. And then it sort of tapers off as you get to 55, you're only getting half a chilling unit. And as you get up to 60, you're getting none. And above 60, it's actually reversing. The Utah model seems to be the best evidenced model. And so that's the one I go by in terms of whether or not we're getting what the fruit trees need. With 709 units before we're even in January, I think we're absolutely fine for almost all the fruit trees that we grow in this area. But as I said, I've never seen such a striking difference between the two models that are out there. And if you want more information on this, you're interested in this whole phenomenon of chilling calculation and all that kind of thing, fruitsandnuts.ucdavis.edu, and just look for weather products or weather models. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, if you like the Davis Garden Show and all the other great programming, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And if you didn't give us a year-end donation, we're always happy to take year-start donations. kdrt.org, look for the donate or support button.
Well, it's January 1st. Is anything happening out there in the world, Don?
Anything out there? Well, one of the most important things that's happening for fruit tree people who are interested in expanding their horizons is the world famous California Rare Fruit Growers Scion Exchanges are once again about to begin, not just around California, but other states as well. So if you are someone that's looking to graft or bud on unusual varieties, or just get to know people who do that and know people who are interested in all the unusual varieties that can be grown in your region that may or may not be available at your local garden center or hardware store, you can go to crfg.org, California Rare Fruit Growers, crfg.org/2026-scion-exchanges. How do you spell scion? S-C.
Scion.
Correct. So the Scion exchanges are all listed. And for local listeners, we go through Arizona, Orange County, Los Angeles, North San Diego County. Here we go. Inland Empire, Sacramento Valley Chapter Scion Exchange will be held Sunday, February 8, 2026, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at La Sierra Community Center. We will give you more information as we get closer, but mark your calendar. If you're interested in budding, grafting, exchanging, you have some unusual varieties of deciduous fruit species, no citrus, please, deciduous fruit species, then you can go to that Scion Exchange Sunday, February 8, 2026, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at La Sierra Community Center.
Well, the reason we know about that is that we were looking things up after having gotten this email. Oh, we'd love to get emails. Thank you. And this is from Braden. who writes, "Dear Don and Lois, I wrote to you about a year ago to get your advice on turning an ornamental red leaf plum tree into a multi-graft stone fruit tree. I still like the term Franken tree. And I am writing to give you an update on the project. You advised that the California rare fruit growers would be a good source of information and science. I joined their Sacramento chapter and followed the group on Facebook. They are a kind and generous group, passionate about growing fruit and eager to share information and experiences. I attended their Sacramento Scion Exchange last February. It was great. I got about 100 scions, 100, about 50 varieties of plums, pluots, figs, mulberries, feijoa for only a $5 entry fee. It was amazing. I also donated hundreds of scions from my home garden. Donating to the exchange was surprisingly rewarding. It felt great seeing people smile as they chose one of my cuttings, which had just been pruned waste otherwise. After obtaining a variety of scions from the exchange, I pruned back one of my red leaf plums. It's called Crater Vesuvius. Pruned back that tree and added 95 grafts of 33 varieties of plums and pluots. My goodness. My initial success rate was pretty high, but not every grafted scion grew, and many dried out or got dislodged by high wind after an initial flush of growth. At the end of the first season, 42 grafts survived, representing 30 different varieties. Wait a minute, right? This is all in one tree? Oh my gosh. The tree looked healthy and has regrown to nearly the same size it was before I pruned it back, with the strongest grafts exceeding 1.5 inches in diameter.
Yeah, so stop right there. I was just
Not
talking.
length,
Stop right there.
diameter.
I was just talking to a customer who was about to embark on grafting and budding and had the impression that it's going to take a really long time for a bud to grow out and become a branch. No, if it takes, it takes quickly. And in fact, you know right away, some of them fail. From my experience, for a lot of beginning grafters and budders, a lot of them will fail. But what one does, it's very exciting when it does, and it will grow just like a regular branch at that point. If it's healed in, essentially, its cambium has grafted to the cambium of, in this case, the Crowder Vesuvius red leaf plum. It'll become a branch very quickly. So that's something to know, that this is not a long, long, tedious process. I would say the only tedious part of the process is the grafting and budding itself, which just is handwork. So go ahead.
Despite my less than 50% graft success rate, I am very pleased with the project. As a teacher, I would call this type of project, quote, low floor, high ceiling, unquote. Because a beginner can use simple techniques and inexpensive materials to get reasonably good results, while experts work for years to push the boundaries of what is possible and what is known about grafting. I will keep experimenting with this tree. I'm looking forward to seeing which varieties flower and fruit this year, and I plan to add peach and apricot grafts using previously grafted Adara plum and pluot branches as interstems. Don, you're going to have to explain
No, I
what
think
that
he's,
interstem thing is.
well, he's moving on to the next phase of grafting. That's fine.
Oh, okay. I will also begin to top work the other two Crowder Vesuvius trees on my property to grow a variety of peaches and pluots. And you're going to have to explain top work too.
We'll be happy to do that at some point. Go ahead.
Okay. Sacramento chapter of the California Rare Fruit Growers will hold their next sign exchange in February on the 8th in Carmichael. Entry cost is $5. CRFG membership is not required to participate, but it does allow early entry, among other benefits. I love the Davis Garden Show and appreciate all the knowledge and care that the two of you put into it. I listen every week and have learned a lot. Some highlights from this year were Lois's suggestion to use spent Salvia clevelandii flowers as garden air fresheners
Car air
and
fresheners.
car air fresheners. Oh,
Yes.
yes, that's right. And Don's idea to use hot pepper plants in place of poinsettias for holiday color. Keep up the good work
You,
from
Braden.
Braden in Woodland.
Thank you. Well, we're working hard on getting Thai peppers as a replacement for poinsettias in America's horticultural purchases around the holidays. Don't you think that would be great? Just little hot peppers in everybody's house. Yes, CRFG is an extraordinary organization, and one of the things that I really like about it, just as with, master gardeners and others, you're going to meet with like-minded people at all stages of learning. So if you get into grafting or budding, there's a ton of online information available, and it's overwhelming, actually. Just chatting with Andrew, who was in the shop the other day, who's taking on a project of budding onto one of his plums, is a little much. Do you bud? Do you graft? Do you use a T bud? Do you use a cleft graft? Yeah, there's a whole lot of different ways to bring this about. Just explaining really simply, all you're doing is grafting or healing, I guess is the best way to look at it, the cambium of your desired plant, your scion, with the cambium of the other plant, in his case, a Crowder Vesuvius plum or a root stock, by means of cutting in and sticking in a piece that's about the same size and hoping the cambium overlaps, taking a bud out, which is practically surgery, and layering, pulling back the bark of the one that you're putting it onto, and then sticking it in there and pushing the skin back over, the bark back over, and wrapping, wrapping, wrapping like crazy. So it's all a lot of handwork. It takes good eye-hand coordination, but in principle, you're just trying to get the cambium of the good plant, or the one you want, grafted or attached to the cambium of the one that you're growing as rootstock. That's the simple part. There's a bazillion ways to do it. Budding, the advantage of budding is that you have on, let's say, 1 3-foot-long branch, you may have a dozen buds. All right, that 3-foot-long branch would be one graft or a dozen buds. So if you're limited for budwood, you do budding. My experience way back when I took plant propagation was you had to be really good eye-hand coordination to do budding. Grafting is a lot simpler for most people. Grafting, hey, this is the size of a pencil. I'll find a branch on my rootstock that's the size of a pencil. I'll cut them at a certain angle so there's a lot of overlap with the cambium. I'll shove them together, smash them as close as I can, and wrap it with tape and then put wax over it and whatnot. A bunch of different techniques for keeping it from drying out before it scars together or heals together. But there are advantages to both. Some are simpler, and I think for most people, grafting is simpler. But if you've only got a certain amount of budwood to look at, go online, go to re reputable references, and find budding and read about T budding, cleft grafting, angle grafting. That would be a good place to start. Now, we had conversation last week about currants, gooseberries, blueberries, and other things. We had a listener on the coast who was interested in berries, and we talked in great detail about, let's see, caneberries and strawberries and things like that. And I wanted to dig in a little deeper and see if I could find more information for that listener and others about things like the currants and the gooseberries. And what this brought me to was an old topic. Where are you going to get information about things nowadays?
That's right.
Where are you going to find information about what grows, what kinds of berries you can grow on the coast? And what I kept coming back to was the Sunset Western Garden book. Last published in 2012, but I want this is for the listener who wrote in asking about other fruits as well as the ones we talked about. If you're looking in the Western Garden Book and you know the climate zones in the Western Garden Book, unlike the USDA zones, you can make an educated guess about whether a fruit is likely to do well for you. And I looked up some of the things like currants and gooseberries. Let me see the notes that I made here. As an example, they would mention zones 1 through 7 and 15.
That's cold.
Oh, that's, yeah, okay. And then 15 to 17. We're in zone 14, and Sacramento Valley is zones 8, 9, and 14. Once you look at the maps in the front of the Sunset Western Garden Book and you start to realize that it's an overlay of topography on climate, you realize, oh, okay, 1 through 7 is higher elevation. Lake Berryessa is zone 7. It's the foothills, and then zone 1 is the top of a mountain. Okay, so those are cold. Yes, those are very cold, and they're winter-like in the winter climate, and they're generally rainier and so on. So they're nothing like the valley. 15 to 17. That's the San Francisco Bay Area, and
It's foggy.
that's probably where the person who wrote to us is going to be in one of those zones, 15, 16, 17. The way I learned them originally, zone 17 was Berkeley, and zone 16 was uphill from Berkeley. And the old joke was bougainvilleas would grow in zone 17 but wouldn't bloom. They would grow and bloom in zone 16. So you're getting a little further away from the ocean, a little bit warmer. And zone 15, it's one of the most amazing garden climates in California. Sebastopol, Occidental, that whole region of the coast that is uphill or even in the valleys a little bit. So much warmer, but strong coastal influence. That's the key thing. It's a very strong coastal influence. So if you look up gooseberries and currants, you may find them listed for those zones. That tells you that you are likelier to do well with them than we are. So once you have a Sunset Western Garden book and you look things up, you can make an educated guess about whether you're likelier to succeed with things like red currant. We were talking back and forth about how currant is a big group. It is a very big group of plants. There's ornamental currants, there's native currants, and the currant that people grow for fruit, which is a European Ribes, is something that just doesn't take the valley heat, doesn't take our hot, dry conditions. I don't know whether it's just the high temperature or the low humidity or the combination or the frequency of extreme heat events that we get. All of those things just seem to toast currants and gooseberries. I have grown all of them out of curiosity, and they all do the same thing. They flush out in the spring and they flower and they're growing fine. And we have a typical July heat wave. You know, when we get over 100 degrees for a couple to a few days, and the humidity on a day like that may be as low as 10%, desert-like conditions. And no matter what, the leaves just wither, they get spider mites on them, and the plants just decline. Last gooseberry that I grew lasted 3 years. It would grow fine in the spring, look horrible in the summer, and I finally just took it out and got rid of it. So that's because we're in the interior. But zones 1 through 7, which is higher elevation and almost never going to get over 100 degrees, and then 15 to 17, coastal but warming as you go from 15 to 16 to 17 to 16 to 15. You probably can do them. You will need to be aware that we're more arid than most of the places these plants grow, even when you're in the coastal zone. So you will need to irrigate them. These are not going to be drought tolerant plants, but you're likelier to succeed with them. That goes for currants in general, gooseberries, jostaberry, which is a hybrid between those things. Those are just likely to do better in the coastal zones than here. Finding the varieties will be the fun part. So this is a case where I had a book all about berries. I mean, thank you, Andrew, for bringing me all these fascinating books from the library. And they're available for people to borrow and buy. And in some cases, we'll just give them to them. And this was like a comprehensive book on berries. I thought, this is exciting. Now I've got the information I need. It was written by someone from Rutgers who had spent much of her career in the Pacific Northwest. Published about 20, 25 years ago, looking up currants and gooseberries. And in each chapter, there'd be a list of varieties for different regions. Except they wouldn't list California at all. Wouldn't list California whatsoever, which I thought was a little strange until I went to the introduction. And I do highly recommend reading the introduction of a book first before you start reading the book. One of the nation's foremost experts on these types of berries. Recommended cultivars are not provided for California and some of the adjoining desert states. The reason for this exclusion is that the plants in this book are all temperate zone crops. Do not perform well in non-temperate climates. That's a little technical jargon. Temperate doesn't mean what you think it does. It basically means places where deciduous trees grow well. That's temperate, not subtropical. California is an obvious exception, as that state is a major producer of strawberries and also has some raspberry production. The production systems in California are somewhat different, and many of the cultivars grown there are proprietary. It is also strictly large-scale farming, primarily for an export market, so the principles do not translate well to the home garden. So this is a foremost expert on berry production, essentially stating that California, she couldn't recommend any varieties because we're too arid. That's what it boils
Well,
down to. And so it is true. It would be very hard for me to make a recommendation for a specific variety for a coastal zone in California. You're just going to have to try and see what works for you. But you're probably not going to find the information that you need online, that's for sure. And when the experts can't give you varieties, we're going to be hard pressed to do so. So you'll have to just do a little experimenting.
I object to her, California and other desert areas.
Well,
Wait a
this is
minute.
okay.
California is huge
Yes.
and we have lots of different climate
Yes.
areas. We
Yeah.
have, we,
I
oh.
noticed this before I even went into the nursery business. We used to get Horticulture Magazine, which was the premier magazine for serious horticulture folks, not to be confused with things like Sunset Magazine, which was more for gardeners. And they had regional editors who would put their little columns in there about what we're doing at different times of year. They could not figure out what to do with California because
It's too
California
big.
is, well, it is two different states with respect to climate, that's for sure. Southern California and all the way up into the Southern Central Valley are Southwest, in my opinion. Growing up in San Diego, it was in the Southwest. You're basically similar in many ways to Arizona and other and the desert states. You get low rainfall, you have Santa Ana winds, you have periods of very dry weather. Yes, on the coast, of course, it's much milder. You're tempered by the strong coastal influence. So that's its own special little zone, basically. But Southern California and the Southern Central Valley would be one thing. The Northern Valley, the Sacramento Valley, and of course the northwestern part of the state are totally different. The northwestern part of the state is basically like Oregon. So if you're up in Eureka, you know full well that it's not like the rest of California. You can grow currants and gooseberries just fine, and you probably would get great information from Oregon State or someplace up there that has varietal information. In the Sacramento Valley, we do have, we're hot. We're dry. We have more rainfall. We have more water, almost for sure, every year than Southern California typically does. And so we can try different things. But the thing that really affects us is the fact that we get no rainfall from about May 1 to about middle of October. And the humidity for long periods of time here, July, August, September, is similar to deserts. I mean, it's not as dry as Anza Borrego, but we are down in the 10%, 15%, 20% range very commonly on summer days here. And plants that are understory plants, which is what most of these are, currants, gooseberries, things like that, understory plants that would be in a woodland environment with lots of organic material coming down from trees and rainfall through a much broader part of the season, fog into the summer, they're just not going to be as happy in our dry, hot summer climate. The other thing is that surface organic material makes a huge difference. So if you're growing any of these things, if you're going to try currants, if you're going to try gooseberries, put them where they're not near a path. If you're going to try gooseberries, if you're going to try blueberries, any of those things, mulch them. Mulch, mulch, mulch. That really is the key to success in a drier, hotter climate than these plants are typically accustomed to. I did find a great phrase as I was looking this up, and I just have to pass this along so you all can popularize this. From archaic American English slang, a huckleberry over my persimmon.
That mean then?
A huckleberry over my persimmon was, not sure when or where, used to mean a bit beyond my abilities. That's just a huckleberry over my persimmon. Okay.
Oh my.
On the other hand, they go on, I'm your huckleberry is a
Oh,
way of
that's a sweetie.
expressing affection, one that is just the right person for a given role. The range of slang meanings of huckleberry in the 19th century was broad, also referring to a significant or a nice person. It can also be a slang expression for a rube or an amateur or a mild expression of disapproval, but I think we'll stick with that's just a huckleberry over my persimmon.
So Don had sent me a message that he got from Dave Wilson saying, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's we are reaching out with an important update regarding OHXF333 on 2026 bare root orders. This is telling you that this, it sounds like it's a rootstock, and the rootstock's not available. But I can't understand what the rest of it means. If the rootstock's not available, it just means you're not getting any plants.
Yes, a confirmed crop failure of the OHX F333. There's three threes on there.
We'll just call it threes.
It's a very popular rootstock for pears. Well, it failed. As a result, all the pears that you ordered on this rootstock, which is the most common rootstock for pear trees, will be canceled. There will be no remaining availability and no substitutions available for this. So what this means, all you out there are going to be very few pear trees available bare root. I'm talking about fruiting pears at bare root in nurseries, garden centers, hardware stores this year, because a significant percentage of pears are grown on this rootstock. It has a lot of advantages. I don't know what would cause a crop failure on this particular rootstock. I don't know why they would only notice it in late December, when they're getting ready to ship all of the bare root fruit trees, but I'm glad they brought this to our attention. If you were thinking of adding some pear varieties to your home orchard this year, you may have trouble finding them. That's what it comes down to. So they're not going to be shipping any pears. I'm not going to, at my nursery, I had four different pear varieties on order, five different pear varieties, three Asian pears and two European pears. Well, I'm not going to get any of them. Zero. Now, if this were peaches, plums, nectarines, apricots, I'd be very, very upset. Don't sell that many pears. Pears are not that popular with backyard home gardeners. And there is another rootstock that is used. They sometimes actually use Caleriana pear, the same one that you know as Bradford pear. They do use that as a rootstock sometimes. And some Asian pears are grown on the birch leaf pear, Betula folio, which is actually a beautiful tree in its own right. So if they happen to order, the garden center you work with happen to order on those rootstocks, then they might get their pears. Those of us that ordered on the OHXF333 will not get our pears. So there'll be a shortage of pear trees out there. I just wanted to bring this to your attention in case this was the year you were thinking of populating your family orchard with pears.
So, Don, I would like to talk about pruning. And you wrote an article, and I have it in front of me. It's called Pruning Notes by Fruit Type. And just so that listeners understand that when I'm talking about the type, and what I mean is, where do the fruit grow? So if you've got apples, you have spurs, and the apples grow on the spur. And the spur stays, it's persistent. It stays there year to year to year. Same with the plums. My plums have spurs and they just keep going. So if they're on spurs, you're going to want to prune one way. And if they're on not on spurs, then you're going to prune another way. So
Yeah,
here
that's
we
what.
have by fruit type.
Right. And boy, that's what it boils down to is where do they fruit? And therefore, what are your pruning, is your strategic objectives in pruning? We'll talk about training separately. Training is what you're doing with a young tree. You're deciding whether you're going to have a branch very low and so on. That's a different discussion. But this is going to be pruning notes by fruit type. And we'll start with the one that's the exception.
Peaches and nectarines?
Yep. Because they
No
fruit.
spurs.
No spurs, correct. And this is an important thing to know about them. They only fruit on new wood, which is one of those bits of jargon that you learn when you take courses on
It's
fruit.
the redwood, right?
New wood versus old wood. Well, new wood, what grows this year, next year it's wood. So the year it's wood, it's new wood. It's new growth. The next year it's new wood. And in the case of peaches and nectarines, it's very handy. They're color-coded. The new wood is bright red, and all the older wood has turned gray. And the wood that is red will fruit. And the wood that is gray will not. So this is simple, at least in principle. They're also very vigorous trees, and the fruit's the size of a baseball or softball, depending on the variety. It's pretty heavy, and they try to set fruit at every possible blossom, all the way down that branch of new wood. So if you allow that, the tree will fall apart. Not only will you have way too much fruit, but branches will break. In fact, the whole tree may break apart. So peaches and nectarines are easy because they're color-coded, but they must be pruned every year. And this is one of the only cases where they absolutely must be pruned every year, or they will fall apart. They must be pruned for size control and to reduce fruit production.
So if each fruit is the size of a baseball, then and every place it flowers is going to try and make a fruit, and the flowers are 2 inches apart,
Yeah.
it won't fit. Do you
That's
have to
correct.
pluck off flowers or something?
You pluck off fruit, but that's after you've pruned. So each year, if you don't remove a whole bunch of that fruiting wood, the tree will overproduce and the branches will split and collapse. So the first part of controlling that is the pruning you're doing. When we had a pruning crew, as a rule, we would thin out about half of that red stuff, about half of the fruiting wood, remove it completely. Where it came up from the main trunk. And we would always warn the customer, this is going to be severe. And then we would head back the remainder by half. So
Oh, my goodness.
75% reduction each year in the fruiting wood. If you don't do that, they'll fall apart. To your point, yes, you also should go out there when they flower, especially a year with lots of sunshine, lots of pollinators. You should thin the fruit so that they're one fist apart, is the old rule of thumb. So you've cut off 3/4 of the fruiting wood, and then you're going to take off as the fruit has set shortly thereafter, a fair percentage of the fruit as well. Now, a lot of us don't get around to that. We just get a lot more fruit and it's smaller and it's still perfectly good. So that's fine. So the fruit thinning is not as crucial if you've pruned correctly. And then it's very easy to keep peaches and nectarines down because we highly recommend summer pruning for size control on them. Let them grow out, enjoy your harvest, and then go in, get up on a little stepladder and just go ahead and cut back. a lot of the stuff that's grown this season just for size control. So that's one of the other goals, is to keep the fruit within picking range. Why? Because when a peach falls to the ground, it's usually no good at that point. So you want to be able to pick them off the tree. That's the size control is important, but the reducing the amount of fruit is actually one of your main goals. And they're very easily kept under 10 feet by summer pruning. Last note on peaches and nectarines. People, it's a lot of pruning and you need to do it every year. People want to reduce that by getting a quote semi-dwarf rootstock. That doesn't reduce it. That just makes it grow a little more slowly. You still have to prune it every year. So semi-dwarf rootstock doesn't do it. If you don't want to prune at all, look for the miniature peaches and nectarines. They're great. They're a shrub. They grow 6 inches or maybe a foot a year. They're very tight internode distances. The newer varieties have very good quality fruit, and you can just stick them on the edge of your vegetable garden. They're really pretty. They're cool. They're interesting. The fruit is full size, and you never have to prune them at all, except maybe thin them out a little bit.
Okay. And then we turn go on to can we go plums, pluots, and apricots together, or are they different?
They're different. Plums and
Okay,
pluots are
plums.
basically the same. So they fruit on spurs. Lois has a plum
Yeah.
tree, and you can see the fruiting wood, and that's you'll see a whole bunch of flowers all in one place, and there are a bunch of fruit clustered in one place. We don't really care about the size of plum fruit that much for whatever reason. So we don't worry that much about the fact that there's, I don't know, 700 fruit forming on there, a huge number. The spurs, this is important, do last for many years. So they're long lived, 10, 15 years plus of the spurs will live. The numbers increase as the tree grows. So you don't absolutely have to prune plums at all, but if you don't, after several years, they will set so much fruit that the branches will start to break. It's after several years. It doesn't happen right away. So a lot of people find plums really easy for the first 5 or 6 years. Train them like a tree, enjoy the fruit, begin to realize you're getting 300 and then 500, 600 fruit. You may want to prune them just to reduce the amount of fruit, but it's not as crucial as it is with peaches and nectarines. The one thing that they do is they have vigorous upright shoots. We call them water sprouts. Some people call them suckers, although technically we prefer to use that term for things that have come up from below the graft union. But vigorous upright shoots that just go
This
for
is at the
the sky.
top. This is at the top of the tree. I know this from experience. And it goes straight up, reaching for the sky. And you know, if you don't prune that thing off for 2 years, you'll have the best cat toys you've ever seen because they'll be 15 feet tall.
And they'll start to form spurs in about 3 years in, and then you'll have way too much fruit way up high. And that's when you might actually start to get some limb breakage. Take out those vigorous upright shoots, then do a little shaping on the tree, thin them out, and do some strategic pruning to reduce fruit production. And again, very amenable to summer pruning. So you can go out there after the harvest, after everything, after all the spring and early summer growth is done, and you can just top them down and keep them under 10 feet without much difficulty. Same goes for pluots, although personally, I've found they're a little more variable by variety as to which ones get bigger, which ones stay smaller, but you can handle them just like plums.
Down at the base of the tree, and it's either, I think it's coming off of the roots, but there are lots of shoots jumping up.
We call those suckers.
Suckers?
And the only distinction is whether they're above or below the graft union. So if they're coming from below the graft union, then they're the root stock, which is sending up suckers. If they're above the graft union, they're water sprouts, which is the scion. You can call them suckers either way if you want to. They generally need to be removed. That's the key thing. They'll crowd the inside of the tree and they won't fruit for 2, 3, 4 years. So most people take them out. That's usually the first thing we would do. We'd walk up to a plum. First of all, is there anything that has to be cut off because it's diseased or damaged or injured or something like that? We'd do that part first. Then we'd spend a few minutes taking those water sprouts or suckers out completely, because then we could see the structure of the tree, what we really needed to do for shaping, size control, and reducing fruit production. You may just prune, a good rule of thumb is you generally prune harder and harder as the years go by, simply because plums will overfruit. Or as they put it in one Oregon State University publication, will fruit themselves to death. They will fruit so much, they'll collapse. And so you do want to prune them to reduce that likelihood.
Okay, well, let's move on to apricots. Now they're on spurs also. Are those spurs like the plum spurs, or are they different?
They're different in the sense that they only live for a few years. So a spur on an apricot lives 4 to 5 years. That's why apricots need some little special attention to the pruning. If you do nothing, the spurs that are down at picking level will slowly die out after a few years, but there'll be more spurs forming up higher and higher and higher and higher on the tree. Makes a
I'm not
lovely,
climbing ladders anymore, Don.
right? Me neither. It makes a lovely tree, but again, like a peach, an apricot that falls and lands on the ground is usually not much good. So you want to pick them off the tree. They work with a fruit picker if you happen to have one, but easier is to train them low when they're young and prune them to reduce the likelihood of the spurs all being way out there. So some takes a little more skill to prune an apricot correctly. You're pruning for size control and also to renew the spurs on the interior. They have a tendency, although much less so than plums, to do those upright water sprouts or suckers. So those get taken out. Other than that, they have a more spreading habit and they're very graceful, lovely trees. So I do recommend if you're buying a bunch of fruit trees and you're trying to scatter them around the yard and figure out where they should go, the apricot can be a real focal point because it does have a really nice growth habit. It's a very attractive tree. It's not that difficult to keep them down. Two important things about apricots. One is that renewal of the spurs needs to be done, and you may want to get someone to help you with that that knows what they're doing if you can't figure this out on your own. It's not that difficult, but be aware of it. You have to prune to renew the spurs. Also, don't prune apricots in the winter. So all these other things we're talking about, you can prune right now. January, February is fine. But apricots are susceptible to a disease, Eutypa, Eutypa, which infects through pruning wounds when we have rain during the pruning season. Well, it rains here during the pruning season. So we don't recommend pruning apricots at all during the winter. You do them only in the summer, July, August, September. So while we're doing summer pruning for size control on peaches and plums and apricots, that's when you're doing your main structural pruning and your renewal of the spurs. So you handle them rather differently. We didn't do this in the old days. About 20 years ago, they realized the connection between pruning and Eutypa infection can kill a part of a branch, can kill a whole branch. I watched it kill an entire tree one time because we had a very rainy season shortly after it had been pruned. So we don't prune apricots in the winter. I assume that this also applies to apriums, but I don't know for sure because apriums are new. Apriums are a cross between an apricot and a plum. They're not a pluot. They're not a plumcot. That's the other direction. They're mostly apricot with some plum parentage. And I'm just going to assume that they're susceptible to Eutypa as well because they at least look more like apricots and plums. So that's my highly scientific evidence for this. So we would prune apriums only in the summer as well. And other than that, you don't do hard pruning on them. Typically, you're pruning to open up the tree a little bit, remove the upright shoots, size control, so you'll be able to pick the fruit and renew the spurs.
Well, then we come to apples. Now, they fruit on spurs, don't they?
Yes, and the spurs are very long-lived. They can live for decades. And so once you have spurs on an apple, a spur is a very recognizable short shoot. And on apples, it's particularly recognizable. On apricots, they're kind of skinny, although you pretty quickly, when they bloom, figure out what they are. On apples, as with cherries, the spurs are very recognizable, short, stout, little fat buds on them. That little spur there is going to give you apples for years. And so once you have spurs distributed at the level you want, perhaps on a tree you've shortened up or grown on a very dwarfing rootstock or trained as an espalier, they're particularly good for that. You'll get fruit there year after year after year. So you just keep pruning it back to the basic structure that you've come up with. The only issue with apples is that they grow straight up. If you've ever grown an apple tree or a pear tree, they shoot for the sky. And so people bring in pictures, go, what do I do? I said, you take the center out and you just have to keep doing that. Is he going to do it again next year? Yep, they're going to do it again next year. That's basically your main goal with them is to keep them from getting 30 feet tall and showering you with apples 20 years down the road that you can't reach. Good news, an apple falls from the tree, it's usually still good, but you still don't want the trees to be as big as they want to get. So that strongly upright growth habit is the main thing you deal with when you're doing pruning on apples and pears. Most people take out the central leader at the time that they plant it, and then they train the tree for good branch placement. They usually use a modified central leader technique on them, and they try to get something to spread the branches out. I can tell you that as time goes by and you get heavier crops, the weight of the fruit itself will cause the tree to get a broader habit to some degree. But keeping them shorter has a couple advantages. I mean, you can let them grow as big as you want. I remember seeing a golden delicious apple. It was 25 by 25 feet. That was a lot of fruit on the ground, but it was a lovely tree. You can allow that to happen if you want. But if you want to try and control coddling moth or prune out fire blight, you're going to need to spray the tree, or in the case of coddling moth, get up and bag the apples. Well, then you want them to be pickable, prunable and baggable from a small step ladder. I don't want you guys going up on big ladders. So you want to keep the tree shorter, primarily for pest control reasons and access to the fruit. So the main thing is that upright growth habit. You do not need to worry about renewing the spurs. That's one of the reasons apples are so popular in small backyard plantings in England and places where they plant them on the fence and train them as an espalier. You can get a surprising number of fruit on a plant that you've trained on one panel of fence. And so that's one of the reasons that they're popular for that purpose. The wood is very flexible and bends readily, so you can actually train it quite easily into an espalier pattern.
So what's a pear like?
Like an apple. That was easy.
Okay.
Growth
Okay.
habits strongly upright, same thing, long-lived spurs. The big issue with pears is fire blight. We strongly recommend you buy fire blight resistant varieties when you're doing your shopping for pear varieties. But like an apple, the wood's flexible, can be bent, they can be topped down for size control. Fire blight is typically pruned out when you see the damage. If you're out there now and you see blackened, dead, short shoots on your pear, this is a good time to prune those out. You can also do that in the summertime. So if you're going to try and manage a fire blight susceptible pear variety, you really definitely are going to need to get some do some size control to keep it within reach. Better in the long run, since pears are in general very susceptible to fire blight, but some varieties are resistant. Just look for a resistant variety when you're planting a pear. Moonglow, Fan Still, Warren. In the case of Asian pears, I'm pretty sure Shinseiki is resistant. That's going to be an important characteristic, especially in our area, because fire blight is a huge problem here in the Sacramento Valley. Other fruit types that don't absolutely need to be pruned, but you may choose to for one reason or another.
Pomegranates.
Exactly. Pomegranates are a great plant. You don't have to do anything to them if you don't want to. They turn into a giant shrub. Here's the thing, they're almost always on their own roots. I've never seen or heard of pomegranates being grafted, and certainly none that I've ever sold have been. They root very easily. If you've got a friend that's got the best pomegranate you've ever had, get a cutting from them right now, stick it in a pot, pretty good chance it'll root for you. They're quite easy to root. They fruit on, it took me a while to exactly figure this out because they don't fit the pattern of peaches, nectarines, plums, apricots, apples, all that kind of thing. They fruit on the twiggy growth that is at least 2 years old. I wrote that down when a pomologist said it to me. The twiggy growth that is at least 2 years old. You don't usually really prune them at all. And so we've just found it's a great ornamental tree. The flowers are beautiful. They're April, May bloom with red flowers. The fruit is very showy. If you don't eat it, I guarantee there are things that will. And the fruit is quite attractive hanging on the tree, and the fall color is really nice. And hey, if you like pomegranates and don't like the fruit, there's some flowering ones that don't fruit. So there's all kinds of choices. But basically, the pruning you do is shaping it, keeping it down for picking if you happen to want to do that. Other than that, don't worry about it.
I wanted to ask you about figs. Now,
Yeah.
figs, they have two crops a year. And you explained it in here, which I had never heard before. Tell us about figs.
Here in the Sacramento Valley, where figs have been a commercial crop since the late 19th century, they are known to fruit on both one-year-old wood and new growth. And the one-year-old wood will produce the breba crop, it's called. So we get figs in the late spring, early summer here. My opinion is they're not that great. They don't have the sugar content. They're not as good as the figs in the real fig season, but it's a nice bonus. And by the way, there's a lot of demographics out there that get really excited about figs. There's people in New York and Chicago and other places who are growing figs that they should not be growing figs, but they carefully wrap them in the winter. They cut them back hard. They bury them. They don't get the breba crop because they basically have cut everything off or they had too cold conditions when they would be getting that. Then we get the summer crop, which starts here August into September and continues even into October, depending on the variety. A fig that's unpruned is a really big tree
Yeah.
in most cases. The biggest fig I've ever seen was a, I assume, Cadota fig in the Healdsburg area that was easily 60 to 80 feet tall. And of course, massive numbers of fruit on the ground. Fruit litter is a real consideration in siting a fig tree in your yard. They're also very prunable. So almost all the pruning that's done on figs is for size control to make it easier to pick the fruit because it is a soft fruit. And so if you can't reach it, it's going to fall down and just spoil on the ground. And we are talking a couple thousand fruit easily on a well-established fig tree, if not more. So pruning is usually done for size control to make the fruit easier to pick. Most of them are very big trees. However, there are dwarf figs. There are some dwarf varieties that are very good quality. Little Miss Figgy, Blackjack is a dwarf, slow-growing variant of Black Mission, apparently. And then there's one that's been around for a long time called Violetta de Bordeaux. Now, it's a beautiful purple fig, and this little plant has very tight internode distances, so it grows, I don't know, 12 inches a year, easily kept down any size you want. Violette de Bordeaux will fruit almost anywhere. So there are dwarf figs available. But figs are very prunable, and you won't really hurt them by pruning them.
So I want to warn listeners that if you have a volunteer fig come back up in your yard, well, it's a volunteer fig and it probably is not going to be very tasty. And if you let that thing grow, you will never get rid of it.
Thing is very big.
I
Yeah.
have, well, no, I, it's not that they get big. It's that I cut them down and they come back from the roots and I cut them down and
Yeah.
there's more roots and I cut them down. And I mean, I've been cutting down the same fig for what, 5, 6 years now?
The full-size fig tree has very aggressive roots, and people need to know this. They're described to me as a arid riparian species. I thought that was a great term because the riparian means that they live along streams and they're very good at tapping into seasonal moisture. But in arid regions, that means the seasonal moisture is only at certain times. And I do see a lot of figs naturalized around the area because there has been a fig industry in California since the late 19th century. Those figs are not the kind you're going to buy. So the figs that you are buying are all self-fruitful parthenocarpic seedless figs. Self-fruitful parthenocarpic seedless figs. The figs that were grown commercially and are still grown commercially in California are careful. They carefully plant the pollinizer variety with the one they want, and they went back to Turkey or wherever and brought back the wasp that goes from pollinizer to the desirable species, desirable cultivar, and affects the pollination. They had to do that for the ones they wanted to grow for commercial fig trade. But every home garden variety is self-fruitful, sets fruit without pollination, and is seedless. So the fig you plant in your yard is not going to reseed all over the place. The seedlings that come up are from seeded varieties that were grown for agriculture.
Well, that's actually a very good segue into Jenny, who writes about young fruit trees. Hi, Don and Lois. I am very much looking forward to the upcoming show about fruit trees. Here in Riverside, Sunset Zone 19, I've planted 4 pairs of trees, 2 in a hole, in the past year or two, and would love your guidance. I'm working on a presentation to my UC Master Gardeners training class. Oh, she's becoming a master gardener.
Cool. That's wonderful. Yeah.
She's preparing this presentation on backyard orchard culture, and I will be using photos of my trees as explanations or as examples, rather. So I'm hoping you'll weigh in on how you'd prune them and welcome any other advice you have in mind.
Yeah, we're going to foreshadow this. Oh, 2-in-1 hole works as long as you prune them so that neither one of the two crowds out the other. So that's an important consideration. 2-in-1 hole, 3-in-1 hole. This was a big trend when we opened our nursery. And so I would go into yards 10, 15, 20 years later and see where people had done that and then kind of lost interest. What would always happen was one of the trees would outgrow the other. So, real important just on that particular element to make sure that you're pruning the two trees, which may only be 4 feet apart, as if they were one tree, I guess is the best way to look at it. So, don't let one of them hang over the other, crowd out the other, and they should probably be trees of the same type and preferably on the same rootstock so that you don't end up with problems of one, as I say, crowding out the other one. So that would be the important part of that. In general, I will steer you towards modified central leader training. And this is going to be a perhaps a point of contention in the Master Gardener program because I have found over the years that extension folks and Master Gardener programs tend to focus on vase or open center training. My personal preference is modified central leader training. We'll go into this in more detail in another program, but central leader, it's like shade tree, you know, let the center grow, choose the branch placement carefully, let it grow more or less naturally, but you just do some structural pruning for safety and whatnot. Vase training is what happens when you buy your bare root fruit tree at a nursery and it's an old school nursery person and they cut it in half before you take it home. Okay, well, you're going to use vase or open center training because they've already cut the center out. So that's you kind of stuck with that. My personal preference, what we do at our garden center, when we sell you a fruit tree, we will not cut it back. We'll trim off broken stuff if there is any. We'll sell it to you basically as it came out of the field from the bare root grower. And I always recommend you then plant it, let it grow for the first summer, And either at the end of that summer or the next winter, depending on what it is and how it's grown, then you will take out the center to some degree, but not to the same degree that is done with vase or open center training. Modified central leader training, in my opinion, gives a better balanced tree, a tree that looks more like a tree, but is still small enough, short enough that you can reach the fruit at least from a 6 foot or maybe 8 foot step ladder, depending on what it is and where you made that first cut. So, in starters, as a starter, I'd suggest you look up those three basic training techniques. We'll get into this more as we talk further about fruit trees on in the winter. We also got a note, another note from Jenny about her updated project in her backyard and the plants that she put in and the rose garden and the slope. And there's some pictures. So we want to talk about this because there's a great list of native species and ornamental species were all put together in this lovely, lovely landscape. So we'll talk about some of the choices that Jenny made in an upcoming program. I do want to mention one because this is the time of year that you would be looking for this if you happen to want to do this. This rose called Puerto Rico.
Oh, that's that found rose, isn't
Yeah, a
it?
found rose is a term that's used for roses that were found growing, hence the name, in cemeteries or old cottages or just, been abandoned essentially, or growing in a place where no one's really taking care of them and doesn't really know what they are. And there have always been these rose rustlers, as we called them in the 1980s, who would drive around, especially Texas, Louisiana, where a lot of roses were just planted from cuttings stuck in the ground 100 years ago. And they'd see some rose in front of a house or in front of an old barn or something, doing fine, not being pruned, not being sprayed or fertilized or anything. And they give it a name until someone can figure out what it exactly is, which could never happen. You never know for sure. Antique Rose Emporium out of Texas is a company that I've worked with at times, and they had one called Puerto Rico. Yeah, it's a white rose. It's as clean and bright a white as iceberg. Looking out the window at my Puerto Rico rose that I planted in 2018, and I have left completely unpruned. It is now 8 by 10. Great big outward growing plant that has hundreds of white blooms on it almost any time of year. I even see a few right now hanging on there into the winter time. And it's absolutely pest free as far as I can tell, and can be left unpruned, which I'm sure is the condition in which it was found, but also can be pruned like a normal rose or clipped like a hedge or any of a number of processes like that. So if you're into roses and you have a fair bit of space, I would send you over to the Antique Rose Emporium website. They sell a lot of these, and that's what they call them, found roses. Puerto Rico in particular was a real find for me on my farm as one of their found roses.
Well, Don, kind man that he is, brought me a present yesterday. And Don, where did you get this book? It's a beautiful book.
Thank you, Andrew. Came from the Yolo County Library.
The Gardener's Guide to Life. And I want to promote the Friends of the Library have a book sale every month. I don't know when it is coming up. We'll give you that announcement later. And you can go and you can get books. And Andrew so kindly finds things for us. It's wonderful. So, our garden quote for the day: the wise gardener anticipates June in January.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California. Wishing you a happy, happy new year. I hope 2026 is your best gardening year yet.